We will take questions from the floor. As I said earlier, please keep your questions brief. We will take them in groups of four and try to direct the flow. Please. We will have mics rotated to you.
Thank you. I would like to know if you think that the movement towards sanctions and boycotts, both here in the United States, whatever may be possible in terms of divestment and boycotts possibly in Europe, do you think that these will be effective potentially?
Another question. We're going to take it in groups of four. Please.
Dr. Hirschkind, I'm curious, when you said you were speaking about the Palestinian suicide bombers, and I was struck by how easy it would be to replace the word Palestinian with Jew and still say the same things, that, well, a lot of their actions, and frequently they are morally reprehensible, they come from the attempt to annihilate a race, an occupation of over a millennia, and the diaspora of millennia. I'm curious on your comments.
Okay, one. Over there, please. Right, the person in the black t-shirt had his hand up for a while. Okay.
My question is going to be addressed to Professor Zaatari, is it?
Zaatari, yeah.
This question is for you. What is Resolution 475 exactly?
And one more question back there. To your right.
First, I appreciate what everyone has said. I think it's a wonderful teach-in. Glad we're all here. The last speaker, Professor Damani, said in the middle of his talk that that there seems to be an international consensus that 1967, that is the withdrawal of the territories before 1967, was a solution, and then you close with a remark saying that that doesn't seem to be viable by anyone. And yet Professor Zaatari said that 1948, there was an instantaneous dispossession of 80% of the Palestinian people, and the creation of Israel was itself a hostile act, a colonial act. And that is the taking away of the lands of a people, whatever the justification. It seems to me that the demand, and I'd like your comment on it, the demand of the PLO in 1973 was a reasonable one. They called for a democratic, secular Palestine in which Israelis, Jews, Arabs can live together as equals based on the right to return. For 50 years, they've been trying to organize some kind of two-state solution. And the two-state has gone from 52% to 40% to 30%, and now what's left of Palestine is 17% and shrinking. As one of the speakers said, what's left of Palestine is an open-air prison.
Okay.
So I don't think there is a solution on that. I'd be interested in your view on the democratic, secular Palestine.
Okay. So I'm afraid not every question can be answered, but I hope that the speakers here can address the gist of it so that we have more of a chance of questions from the floor. Please, I won't direct it to any single one of you. Whoever wants to take up parts of what has been posed from the floor, please free to do so.
Take your finger off the button.
Now? Oh, sorry, okay. Not that technologically literate. The resolution is 425, and it was passed in
425.
Well, I don't know what resolution 475. What I mentioned was resolution 425 that was passed in 1978 by the UN after Israel bombed and then invaded part of Lebanon, and it asked for Israel to withdraw from Lebanese territory and called for the creation of the UNIFIL, the United Nations Interim Forces, that were going to be some sort of a peacekeeping mission in Lebanon. And I just want to comment that I do think that, if we are to draw comparisons, regardless of how how different the particular circumstances in the world, locally, etc., but between the movement that took take place in South Africa, and I do see that the degree to which the U.S. has supported Israel militarily over the years, one of the main demands in terms of boycott, the degree of investments that are actually happening now in terms of all these various companies that either send profit, net profits, percentages of their profits to Israel to build settlements, etc. I do believe that a boycott divestment campaign is an essential component that the international community can contribute, because whatever is going to happen in terms of liberation has always been something that is a local project. But what the international community can contribute is actually to really focus on a very developed and sustainable boycott divestment campaign internationally that can perhaps hurt them, because it seems economically is one of the main ways by which they can actually get hurt in that sense, if you want.
The hall only till 8 p.m., so we need to really quickly move through the answers so that we get more people here to ask questions.
Very quickly, the end of violence is the first step towards the end of occupation, and the end of occupation by itself will not bring peace, because there'll still be a lot of injustice. That injustice has to do with the very founding moment of the State of Israel of 1948, as you and others have said, and that has to be dealt with. There's all sorts of ways of dealing with it, but at the very least, the world's oldest refugee, its rights under international law have to be respected, and they have to be recognized, and there has to be a way of dealing with that population. Now, what is the best political framework for a kind of a resolution that will be just for all? I know that there's a great deal of attractiveness to the idea of sort of the liberal democratic order, one man, one vote, of the South African struggle, for example. And unfortunately, in this country, if you say one person, one vote, they'll say you're calling for the destruction of Israel, because the very definition of Israel is that it's a Jewish state. So it cannot be a democratic state and a Jewish state at the same time. And if you ask, well, you have to choose between the two, well, the choice is always a Jewish state. So that is a long and complicated topic. Let me just say that the most important and fundamental hurdle that the Israeli people, the Jewish Israeli people, have to come to terms with is a recognition of the right of Palestinians to exist. That's never, ever happened, except for a very brief moment between 93 and 96, I would say, during the Oslo Accords, when there was some movement towards that. Very briefly, when the founding document of the British Mandate, occupation over Palestine, was done in 1922, it included the reference to the indigenous population as the non-Jews. And it included the language of the Balfour Declaration as these non-Jews have civil and religious rights, but no political rights. And the British Mandate never allowed the Palestinians self-representation in a legal way. After 1948, the Palestinian National Movement was constantly referred to as a terrorist organization that they would never negotiate with. The existence of the Palestinian people was not even recognized in the famous, for example, quote by Golda Meir, that who are the Palestinians, they don't exist. And this situation continued even after the Oslo Accords. We cannot have peace as long as Arafat in power, and after the democratic elections of 2006 without Hamas in power, and so on and so forth. It's an iron law. It's an iron law of Israeli government policy, and that has to change. And once that changes, then we can try to think of creative ways of a political resolution.
Any other responses?
Hello? Yeah. Let me just answer very quickly. Where's the fellow? Oh, he's moved. I take it by a race you mean Israeli citizens, who you see as threatened by annihilation. And I would just say, actually, Just wait, please. I would say the opposite is true. Actually, they're not being dispossessed of their land. They're acquiring more land steadily. Their lives are not, their cities are not being destroyed, and they're not being forced into ghettos and living on less than $2 a day. Their economy has consistently been thriving and doing quite well. They are not facing conditions of starvation. On the contrary, they are well fed and actually one of the richer countries in the world. And so, in that sense, I don't think there's any comparison.
Could we go to other questions, please? The person right here.
Yes, I just wanted to say what Professor Damani was saying about Palestinians and Israelis who marry not being able to cohabitate residentially reminds me of what was called in the Nazi era the Nuremberg race laws. My question for, I'm not sure who to direct it to, so whoever feels, you know, they would like to answer it. My question is that, well, first of all, I've written an article originally published in Dissident Voice June 8th called The Left and the Israel Lobby. And that article can be Googled, The Left and the Israel Lobby. And what it does is that it rebuts many of the specious arguments of some of this country's leading progressives who deny the power and influence of the Israel Lobby and also call any critic of the lobby anti-Semitic. So I'm wondering...
What's the question, please?
Yeah. So I'm wondering whether any of the panel members believe that whatever one's position is, that debate on the power and influence of the Israel Lobby is legitimate, or if any criticism of it is anti-Semitic.
Okay. We have another question right at the back, and then two here. Coming to you.
Thank you. I was wondering, my understanding of the panelists was that this is an imperialist, neo-colonialist project. If that's the case, I was wondering if the panelists could share with us what they think the resistance to this new colonialist project would be. Is it going to be in terms of nation states, or is it going to be social movements within the states? You know, what is it?
Okay. There's a person here in the black who's had her hand up for a long time, and then that person in the blue jacket. So we will come to you right there. Okay.
I would like to address this question to Professor Judith Butler and Saba Mahmood. I'd like you to comment on this, the importance of the Hamas and Hezbollah. And I think since the beginning of this year, and especially the when the Hamas was democratically elected by Palestinian people, and the Hezbollah, a lot of Lebanese people are now supporting their violent resistance movement. But yet, even within leftist, you know, anti-war activists or intellectuals, there is always this kind of condemnation and hesitation on supporting these two groups just because of the violent components of, you know, their resistance movement. And doesn't our inability or hesitation in supporting this group does more harm than good to our, you know, solidarity with those two groups? Thank you.
Okay. Person over there in the blue, back behind you, please. Right there behind you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to say I very much agree with what has been said, that we should maybe distinguish between the teaching of Judaism and Zionism, or to use the teaching of Judaism to think about Israel. And the other thing is, the question is that what has been portrayed in the media, Hamas and Hezbollah, they, a lot of times they have not just been portrayed as a force for self-defense, but also as something, Fassel wants to distinguish Israel from the landscape. So this is very often heard in the media, you know, Hezbollah, Hamas, or also the Iranian president wants to distinguish Israel from the land, from the landscape. So is this a real threat, or is it something which is, you know, forced in the media a lot? And yeah.
Okay, four questions. Quickly turning to you, I should just remind you that we have this room only till 8 o'clock. We are 6 minutes from there, so if you speak, please speak quickly. Sorry? We can occupy. Okay, please. Now, we are obligated and we have a future on this campus. So, please. Yeah. I agree. I'm sorry. I wish we had actually more time. Anyways, please.
Okay.
Well, I would just briefly say, I think it's imperative to figure out what the mechanisms are of the various lobbies in the U.S., the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, how they work to help to formulate U.S. policy toward Israel. I think there's no question we need an honest, rigorous appraisal. I think there are some versions of it that strike me as perhaps a little too easily subscribing to conspiracy theories. And I think that there can be an anti-Semitic version, and there can be a really useful, critical version as well. I have no doubt it's a very powerful lobby. I actually think of it as multifaceted, and I think we need more careful, rigorous analyses of it. So, the short answer is when neither has to dispute the existence of such a lobby or its power to prove that one is not anti-Semitic, but neither does one have to accept every version of that, given that some versions are, I think, problematically bound up with conspiracy theories. Similarly, I think, understanding Hamas, Hezbollah as social movements that are progressive, that are on the left, that are part of a global left, is extremely important. That does not stop us from being critical of certain dimensions of both movements. It doesn't stop those of us who are interested in nonviolent politics from raising the question of whether there are other options besides violence. So again, a critical, important engagement. I mean, I certainly think it should be entered into the conversation on the left. I similarly think boycotts and divestment procedures are, again, an essential component of any resistance movement.
Okay. I think we have to close right now. Let me just, a couple of things. Please watch out for our future events. There will be one in the middle of October. Secondly, I just want to make a quick announcement that was passed to me right now. Alexander Coburn will be speaking on campus on October 2nd, 6 p.m., 370 Dwinell, on neoliberal destructions. But thank you very much. I want to acknowledge Samira Ismer's profound organizational skills and her force of her will for bringing us together. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to this.